I'm Ed Levine, and welcome to another special edition of Special Sauce, one of a number of episodes that we're calling The Food Chain. On every episode of The Food Chain, we'll be hearing the stories of folks who make up our actual food chain and how their lives have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Today, we're very pleased to welcome food activist, chef restaurateur, and Top Chef co-host, Tom Colicchio. Tom, along with many of his esteemed colleagues, have formed the Independent Restaurant Coalition to advocate for the millions of Americans who work in and around the restaurant business. He's here to tell us what the IRC is up to as we speak.
Can you hear me?
Yep, gotcha.
How are you?
Okay.
How was your Seder?
Yeah, we did a Zoom Seder. Interesting. it's okay.
I know you've been talking a lot about what's needed, but I thought I would just get everyone up to date. I'm trying to keep everyone who logs out of Serious Eats is up to date on what's going on with all these various packages and what's the lobbying being done. So first, why don't you just identify yourself so we can start there.
Hi, this is Tom Colicchio, chef and owner of Crafted Hospitality, Witchcraft, and co-founder of our newly formed Independent Restaurant Coalition.
Perfect. So first, I just sort of like to take us through kind of what happened to your businesses when?
Looking back, right around sort of mid-January, I'm a bit of a news junkie, and I noticed that this virus that was kind of ripping through China and then Asia, and started thinking like this is only a matter of time before it arrives here. And I think at some point, getting my staff around and saying, listen, if this continues, we're going to be in trouble. And they kind of rolled their eyes and thought I was being an alarmist. And then, two more weeks go by and I was like, guys, like, this is not looking good. And at the time I was actually focused mostly on school, knowing that a school's closed, how many people are going to be hungry, and meeting up with people that I know in the anti-hunger organizations, reaching out and saying, what's the plan there? And then, around March 7th, that we lost, so River Park is attached to a conference center, and we lost about $370,000 in business in 2 days.
Wow.
People canceling. And a huge downtick in reservations, phone stopped, in terms of people booking for events in April, May, June, just stopped. And so it's clear that we were in trouble. I mean, I notified my team was not to stop purchasing wine and liquor and just keep what you have. Notified the chefs to start, ordering, keeping really, really close. Office managers no longer buying office supplies. As it progressed, I think right around it was a Sunday and a Monday, we had two events back to back. We did Cochon 555. And I remember almost canceling that. And, thinking like, I don't know if we want to be around this many people. And
right.
We did it. I left as soon as it started to get busy. So there was like a VIP hour. It wasn't that busy. And I left right after that. And then the following day, we had a fundraiser for Food and Finance High. And the same thing there. It just was like, people were talking about it already. And so after that, I made a decision that we were going to close.
And so that was like around the 10th or the 11th? Or a little later?
Yeah, probably. So once we made that decision, then I started thinking, well, maybe do we stay open for takeout? And then I remember, watching the news and going, I don't want to go out anymore. And I'm afraid that I don't want to bring this home to my family. And I remember telling my mother to stay in, don't go out anymore. And then I thought, well, if I'm staying in, I'm not going to go to work. I certainly can't ask my staff to do this. So we made a decision to close. We picked a date, and we were going to have everybody come to the restaurant. But then I said, why am I asking 300-plus people to come to a restaurant right now? We have to do this by email. As much as I hated doing it by email, I had to do it
right.
By email. And then that was Sunday, and that was our last night.
Wow.
We shut everything down.
And so the drop was precipitous.
Some of the stats that we got from Open Table, they had noticed there's just a dramatic drop in reservations.
Wow.
And again, at that point, listening to doctors saying that we got to, stay inside, social distancing was, starting to happen. And it was just, there's no way that we could stay open. It didn't make sense.
And then a few days later, that's when they officially ordered everyone to close,
right? I started poking around. I gave Danny a call to see what he was up to. And at the time, he was like, yeah, I called him up, I think, the morning of the Friday. I said, hey, we're closing. What are you guys doing? They said, yeah, we're getting there.
Yeah. So did you immediately sort of go into, did you put on your sort of activist organizing hat, of which you have a lot of experience wearing, or?
Well, you know, yes, absolutely. Immediately I thought, okay, there's no way that there's going to be a charitable response to this. And this is what I'm concerned about, because this is, again, the thesis of Laurie's film, was that, you know, looking at something like hunger, which, you know, when you consider what's going on now, is on such a small scale, you know, the experts believe that $30 billion can end hunger in this country.
Right.
By making you know, SNAP more robust and school lunch free, and WIC, you know, more better funded, and with senior feeding programs better funded. And so, you know, thinking like there's no way that, you know, a charitable response can't take care of hunger. How's it going to take care of this?
Right
around this time, you know, and so also that work and the work that I did with Food Policy Action was kind of a dress rehearsal for this.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, knowing a little bit on how the Hill works and having a lot of members of Congress that I'd met over the years. But then out of the blue, I get a phone call from a friend of mine who's an agent at CIA. And he was like, Tom, you know, we have a foundation. We want to help the restaurant industry. And my response to him was, you know, your foundation is not going to be able to help the industry, you know, unless you want to set something very specific for maybe, you know, members of the industry that have medical bills, something very, very specific.
Right.
And then right after that, I get a phone call from a friend of mine who's a lobbyist in D.C. He works for the Environmental Working Group, but he was also worked with us at Food Policy Action in our lobbying efforts. And he called me about something completely separate. And after I got off the phone with him, it was about 10 minutes later, and I said, you know, I think the independent restaurant group, we need a lobbyist.
A lobbyist, yeah.
Right. He got back to me and said, well, then let's do it. Let's get someone. And then I called my friend back and said, all right, I think I know you can do your foundation now. And then we actually managed to get some money from other players as well. You know, I lobbed a DM into Joe Scarborough and said, hey, Joe, you know, lobbyists are going to go to town for these big companies, but small businesses are going to be left out in the dark. And he called me up and said, come on. Next morning I was on. His first question was, hey, Tom, you know, small businesses, small restaurants like yours, you don't have a lobbyist. Like, you know, how are you going to, how do you think you're going to tap into the stimulus if it comes out? And so we already had a lot of fire.
Right.
Yeah. And so we got a lot of help from Sam Cass, because Sam clearly knows how this game is played. And we hired a firm called Thorn Run, and Stephanie Cutter, who is Obama's spokesperson, and the spokesperson for Let's Move is our comms director. Our comms is an amazing job. And Phil Baltz is doing PR stuff for us. And so we put together, this all happened in 2 days.
Wow.
And then what was really interesting is, you know, my hat goes there already. And so, but we started calling around and we found that there was a group of 100 chefs in down south that were focused on this. And we found another whole group in Chicago and another group in Seattle and Portland and all these people. And so we quickly, you know, pulled together leaders from all these different coalitions to create the IRC. And again, within 2 days, we had a team up and running and we were having conversations, you know, at the highest level. And then all of us mined whatever relationships we had with members of Congress.
And yeah.
And a lot of it was really educating the members on how our business works, you know, trying to explain why that we were a great conduit to run stimulus through, because we employ over 11 million people. And then if you look at everyone else that we support when it comes to our suppliers and fishermen and farmers and seed makers and winemakers, that, you know, you're talking for 20 million people.
Right.
The total economy worth over $1 trillion. You know, it's 4% of the GDP. Like, this is worth saving. And And then it just came down to, like, you know, working very closely with the group and working with our team to sort of hone down to what our asks are, what our needs are. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Yeah, and so when you formed the group, I assume it was right before the big stimulus package was passed, and I assume that you tried to make some inroads with those people, and yet what ended up happening left all those people you're talking about sort of unattended to.
Well, yes and no. We're still working. And listen, all the information that we're getting is that they realize that it's deficient in certain areas and they're trying to fix it. So this isn't, our understanding is there'll be a 4.0 and a 5.0.
Got it.
Fixes along the way. And so we're just in there, you know, continuing to let people know what we need and continue to work at this. And so, you know, this isn't a game that you go in there and you hit a home run. It's a bunch And that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
I guess you've learned that lesson over the years in your various causes.
Yep. And it's like, stick to what we're asking, stay focused. You know, it's a combination of working the media, working members of Congress, and just not letting up. The one thing that we did get in there, two things that we lobbied for that we got. One was the sort of franchise rule that's in there. So the idea that, you know, they would say, well, originally it was if you had more than 500 employees, you couldn't tap into PPP. And we said, well, wait a minute, you have restaurant groups that have 2,000 employees, but over 20 restaurants. And so let's look at the individual restaurant, not the whole enterprise. And they did that. And then we got the date pushed back to February 15th, because we said March 1st, we already saw the slowdown way before March 1st.
Right.
So they agreed to that. So they're hearing us. We keep working. You know, we're not going away.
Right.
Which is something else I learned, you know, from the time I spent on the Hill, is that if you go and disappear, they don't take you seriously. You just got to.
Right. Take us through the specific fixes that you urge Congress to address.
You know, right now, what we're looking at, the problem that we have with restaurants is restaurants are closed. See, and this is the other problem, is that this is a small business stimulus, so it goes for all small businesses. But let's just say in the case of a small business that is operating, maybe it's a fly fishing shop that has a good mail order business, so maybe their store is shut down. And so maybe they say, okay, we're still doing business, we're still open, so we're going to, you know, you tap in, you apply for this, you get your loan. Second you're approved and you bring that money down, you get that money, that's when the clock starts ticking.
Mm-hmm.
2 months from that point on, right, that you're going to get your payroll covered for those 2 months. So that kind of works nicely. But what about if you're not open? What about if you can't open? So the day I get approved, I have all this money down, I hire my staff back, but I'm not going to open. So I have 2 months of payroll and rent and utilities. I'm not open. When those 2 months are over, I have to lay everybody off again. But I'm out of money again.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're pushing them to restaurants to change it to when you can actually open up. And we want more. So we're looking for 4 months, you know, 5 months. Because if I can push this out to when I open, let's say, you know, maybe I open in September. Well, then I have four weeks of pay that's already in the bank. And I have 4 months of rent that's already in the bank. Then maybe I have a shot. The only thing I have to pay my suppliers. So we're asking for a separate pool, a stabilization pool of money that we can borrow at very low interest rates at a longer amortization schedule. So then we can actually pay our accounts payable. Then we open.
Right. And that's what you're calling the restaurant stabilization fund?
Yes.
One of the things I think you have tried to get people to pay attention to is that independent restaurants range from your restaurants, which are owned and operated by a quote-unquote celebrity chef, and then there are the thousands of mom-and-pop, you know, ethnic restaurants around the country that don't have a, you know, you're trying to give them a voice too, right? Because they don't, otherwise they're going to be totally shut out.
Right. The work that we're doing is for any restaurant. So absolutely, you know, I'm talking to friends of mine who are in the business who, if I mention, would be like, they should know this, and they don't. And so, you know, I'm calling people up and saying, hey, you should apply for this. And they say, well, I hear this. Just apply for it. Get the wheels turning, because they can fix this to this thing. Just if for some reason you don't want the money, you give it back.
Right.
It becomes a loan. Like, if you can't hire 75% of your staff back, it becomes a loan.
Right.
And so if you don't want the money, just pay it back.
Right. But, exactly. It's like paying a mortgage off early.
Yeah.
There's no penalty.
No, here's the thing. You bring up something interesting. I actually think, and this is a contrary view, I think that the true mom and pop, meaning, you know, the immigrant who came here, saved up some money, they opened up a restaurant, it's an Indian restaurant, you know, the mother and father both work in the restaurant, maybe the kids help out weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'll have an easier time getting through this than restaurants that have, like, a restaurant group that has overhead. Because, number one, a restaurant group, let's just say a restaurant group has 20 restaurants, if tomorrow this is all over, they can't open those 20 restaurants in one day.
No, look at Tom Douglas,
months.
Right? I mean, he...
Months.
He, you know, right. 850 employees lost their jobs at Tom's 13 restaurants. And that's what he says. He says he's not going to... You know, there's no way he can reopen, you know, unless a lot of things change.
No, and when he does, he's not going to probably open up... He's not going to open up all 13.
Right.
He may just let go. And
yeah.
So... I think it's going to be harder because those restaurants just can't open up that quickly. You know, I still put it in, this is the finger in the air, 50% aren't going to open up. Unless, you know, the federal government looks at PPP, takes a real hard look at it, they actually fix it, okay? If we get some sort of stabilization where we can pay even a portion of, maybe you could borrow 50% of your accounts payable, and we have cooperation by landlords, because that's the other thing, you know. The real estate market is going to change. Drive up Fifth Avenue, drive down, whatever. Look at all those stores. Most of them, small business, that occupy the ground floor of all of those buildings. Do they really want them all boarded up?
Right.
I mean, then what happens is those streets are dark, right? And it's just the city doesn't look vibrant anymore. And so somewhere along the line, something's got to give here, because there's no way, given the current situation, is that restaurants are going to open up. We're not going to be at full capacity at all.
Right.
Until there's a vaccine, we're not going to be at full capacity. And so if we don't operate at full capacity, we're losing money. And how long do you think we're going to lose money and pay a landlord, you know, the rent that I'm paying now and continue to do business? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And the
system was broken right. Before this.
Right. Well, landlords that can write that off. Because it's a loss of revenue, so it's a loss that they write off, and they'll keep it vacant. And, you know, that can't last. And I think that landlords are going to have to look at this as being, you know, partners in this.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, again, the game they played was, okay, I have this restaurant, got, you know, someone comes in, they dump $3, $4 million into the space, they have a year run, they go out of business. Well, I have all the stuff, I have all the HVACs, all the fixtures are mine now. Okay, I let the person off the lease. These are mine. They know, you know, it's a matter of time before somebody comes in with key money. You know, people look to expand. So the chef who has maybe one or two restaurants, he goes out and borrows some money because money's cheap right now, pays the key money. He goes in there. Landlord still gets the same rent. So guess what? That's not going to happen anymore. There's no one going in there to pay that rent at that price.
No, and you already see it in New York, at least on the
right.
Upper West Side. There are so many vacant storefronts, even before this all went down.
Everywhere. You go to Bleecker
right?
Street, half the stores are empty. And so what kind of city do we want? A city where you know, a quarter of those buildings are operating and then three quarters are vacant? I mean, it's not going to work.
So in a way, what's weird is that this is sort of by accident shining a light on a really important issue that you're raising.
And I think COVID is shining a light on a lot of inequities in it everywhere. Again, I'll go back to hunger. The need right now, you know, I used to get to talk to these groups. You know, you go into New Jersey and you're in an affluent area and they're giving a talk and they're doing a day where volunteer day where they're filling up bags and they're donating money. And then I get to talk to them and say, you know, this is really nice what we're doing. And I would say, but you know, you're really not making that much of a dent. This feels good to you. that you're doing something. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't help people, but what I want you to do is really, after you're done here, if you really care about ending hunger, you need to use your voice. You need to call your member of Congress and say, this is a priority, okay? And I'll give you an example of why. I said, we're all one disaster, one climate, I used to say climate disaster, away from needing help. And there are a lot of affluent areas on the New Jersey coast after Sandy that people have received food stamps for months.
Right.
So we're all going to be in this position at some point. You may think that you're doing well right now and that's never going to happen, but let me tell you, it can happen. So what you should do is we should be looking at systemic change, not just putting a Band-Aid on the problem. And so the only way to do that is through government intervention. And so what COVID is doing now is really shining a spotlight on the inequities that we have, looking how fragile people are. You know, this idea that people didn't have $400 to save up for something, you know, bad happened. That's happened now for a lot of people.
Right. It was an abstract construct before, you know, when you'd read about those polls that said people live paycheck to paycheck. People didn't take that seriously, right?
Well, or they said, well, that's their fault. What are they doing? Oh, it's the drugs, or maybe they shouldn't have children. Well, now a lot of people are that for no fault of their own. That's what we always say to people. No, it's really no fault of their own. You're born into poverty. It's hard to get out of that.
Okay? Yeah.
So now, no fault of your own, you're going to need help. Don't forget that. Because right now what we need is, when we get through this, is empathy. So we actually can change something. I mean, right now, you know, I thought that Bernie Sanders, the idea of Medicare for all, I thought, this is fine. It's a great idea. You're never going to get 60 votes in Congress. So you're selling a pipe dream. Guess what?
Right.
And now.
Yeah. It seems inherently logical.
What you're seeing is what people always pointed out. When your health care is connected to your job and you lose your job, you lose your health care. Now a lot of people lost their job and their health care.
Right. And none of these packages. And Trump even refused to open the national Obamacare exchanges up.
Yep. Well, this is also something I've been telling lawmakers. Like, if you have in PPP, if we can use that money to fully fund our health care plans, because right now, let's say I pay 50%, my employees pay 50%. Well, they can't. So if I can use PPP to fully fund my insurance, I have a chance of those people coming back now, because they're okay on unemployment, but they're going to think twice. Like, hey, wait, I can go back and get my insurance paid for, get maybe a little less money than my insurance is paid for. I'll go back there. So that's the other thing we're pushing for. What can you use this money for? You can use for benefits, to fund benefits, but I don't know if it's at the same level that I was funding benefits, or I can actually do it at a higher level. I can't see through the other side of this, but I do know on the other side of this that there's got to be something better than what we've been doing.
Yeah.
The country, running our businesses. I think, you know, when you have companies, publicly traded companies that, you know, every quarter they don't hit their numbers, they get punished. And so what do? They do what every business does to squeeze, to make sure that works. They squeeze labor. And, you know, maybe that's going to change.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean,
who knows?
Wouldn't that be the greatest thing that could come out of this, right?
Yeah, right. So what we're going to need is a huge WPA coming out of this.
Right.
This is just so crazy. We go, well, unemployment, the amount of money that the federal government is pumping into unemployment is astronomical. If they just took that and said, okay, once we get through this and start working, let's put people back to work like they did WPA. And if that means you're working on modernizing our electrical grid, you're doing construction projects for roads and things like that, or, you know what, if you're a musician, maybe you get paid to go play music in the park.
Right.
Because we need that. And maybe if you're an artist, you're painting murals like they did back then. And we got beautiful artwork. And maybe if you are, you know, a gardener, someone's paying you to plant a lot of stuff and garden, you know, places in your city and your community so they look great. We're going to need all that.
The question is whether someone will look at it from a macro perspective, or is it just going to be a sort of drip to get to where you're talking about?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, $2 trillion in the first plan is not so much of a drip.
Right. That's kind of a waterfall.
We can you know, sit here forever and debate who gets what and how it's going to get divvied up, but it's still $2 trillion that went out the door.
Right.
And there was also, that was number three. There were two other packages that went out earlier than that. And it looks like there's another $500 billion coming behind this. And they know there's more that has to come out. So we are far away from seeing the end of this thing right now.
Yeah, for sure. So what would you like to say to the serious eaters of the country or the world, for that matter, about what's at stake, sort of in a macro sense, when all is said and done with what you're talking about? And what can they do to support the IRC's initiative?
Well, I mean, the one thing to support IRC, for those that want to support, is call your member of Congress and tell them that you want restaurants open. And, you know, I keep hearing people, you know, they'll ask me, when can you open? When do you think you can open? That's not the question. The question is, when will the public feel comfortable going out in crowded places? And that's not going to be until we get antibody tests so we know who had it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually believe that if we're, you know, a year and a half away from getting a vaccine, then we need to know who has it, see if they're immune. This way you get a card that says you had it so you can go to work, you can go and
right.
places. And then with testing, you know, especially testing where you can get instant tests, where you can instantly test someone maybe at the door of your restaurant, see if they have
right.
it. Then you can make people feel more comfortable about going out. What's at stake here? What's at stake is restaurants are, you know, anchors and communities. This is part of culture. And what we don't want to do, and this is why I think restaurants and other cultural institutions need to be saved, is because what we don't want to do is come out on the other side of this where, yeah, we saved the economy, but we lost our culture. We lost who we are. And so we think about restaurants and we think about how they're used, whether it's to celebrate a birthday or a wedding anniversary or graduation, our first date. And then when you think about the amount of work that restaurants do and chefs do when it comes to actually dealing with other issues, you know, in our communities. And, you know, we're always there. And so we want to make sure that our culture is intact when we're done with this, because if it's not, then who are we? What
yeah.
do we have left? And so if you really believe that we should have restaurants and we should have all kinds of restaurants, if you want to make sure that 11 million people, that's the number of people that work in independent restaurants. Again, not including fishermen and farmers and all other
mm-hmm.
businesses that we support. If you think that's all important, please pick up the phone.
Thank you, Tom Quicchio, for taking the time to talk to us, and stay safe and healthy out there, Tom.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Bob.
Talk
appreciate
to you
it.
Soon.
Stay safe, too. Okay, bye.
Bye.
That was Tom Quicchio giving us a real picture of the state of independent restaurants now, and even more importantly, what he, the IRC, and all of us can do about it. You've been listening to The Food Chain, one of a series of special coronavirus-oriented episodes of Special Sauce that will be airing in the coming weeks. I'm Ed Levine. We'll be back soon with another Food Chain episode of Special Sauce.